You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
This old highway's getting longer. Seems there ain't no end in sight. Sleep would be best, but I just can't afford to rest. I got a ride in Denver tomorrow night. I called the house, but no one answered.
Garth Brooks.
For the last 2 weeks, no one's been home. I guess she's through with me. To tell the truth, I just can't see what's kept the woman holding on.
Yeah, no Ben Conable. So I had somebody email me and said, "Hey Mac, I've heard you and Mike talk about the road to 9/11. I've heard you talk about the audio that, with it, and I don't have access to it. Would you mind playing some of it?" So Mike and I have talked about, you know, the attacks on September 11th, and all of a sudden Don Rumsfeld saying that we need to attack Iraq. All right. So anyway, I want you to hear a few cuts of it. All right. First one is the USS Cole has happened. George Bush has been elected to become president, and they're kind of in this transition in turning over the White House to the Bush administration. So I want you to hear.
More than a day. And it was 100 degrees.
This is talking about the investigation. This is an FBI agent talking about the investigation into the USS Cole, and then this kind of leads into the counterterrorism, you know, effort, and then the Bush administration briefing, and it gives you some sense of where they were in terms of being completely in the dark about this stuff.
This smell that was coming out, and that smell will stay with you forever. That smell of death.
Again, they're talking about the USS Cole.
That was a very difficult moment. We said we really need to bring the murderers to justice.
Soufan and his team quickly traced the attack to an Al-Qaeda cell operating in Yemen.
I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All right, that's George Bush being sworn in.
But 7,000 miles from the port of Aden, an incoming administration seems indifferent to the looming threat.
One of the administration's first reactions was, "Why is the counterterrorism operation here so big?"
That's John McLaughlin, director of the CIA.
They had not heard of Al-Qaeda, many of them. They'd only heard of bin Laden. They didn't know how big the organization was. They didn't know that it...
This is Richard Clark. He's the chief of counterterrorism in the Clinton administration.
Posed a major threat to the United States. It's very disturbing to see the reaction. They looked at us like we were crazy. They really thought we were a little nuts.
Not even Richard Clark grasps how far along the plot has already progressed.
All right, and then the program itself goes on to, as it does throughout, to document, you know, what these terrorists do, and so and how they do it and whatnot. All right. So the next one is that and I asked Mike this question. Mike, was it just a report in a stack that after the event we looked back and said, yeah, these are all these indications? And Mike said, no. Right. This gives you, this next little audio clip will give you some sense of I think to quote it, the system was blinking red. All right, so here you go.
To start their training.
But in the summer of 2001, the American public fears a very different kind of assault.
This 200-plus-pound shark ripped off the arm of 8-year-old Jesse Arbogast.
On 4th of July weekend, a young boy is mauled by a shark, launching weeks of fevered coverage. American beaches as threat zones, bull sharks as terrorists.
Two more people, also in Florida, have been attacked by sharks. Six people bitten by sharks just this weekend. 18-year-old Tim Flanagan, the 16th attack.
The summer of 2001 is quickly dubbed the summer of the shark.
The 50 shark attacks reported worldwide, 39 are in the United States.
For whatever reason, we love sharks. I don't really understand it myself, but Mike Musselman, you know, has what's his saying, that stupid people are easily amused by animals? Sharks were fascinated by, right? So, and this is probably the foundation of Shark Week and Sharknado and all the rest of that nonsense.
At the White House, Richard Clark sees the shadow of a far more terrifying menace.
Well, there was a lot of intelligence coming in that suggested Al-Qaeda was planning something big somewhere. That Al-Qaeda was, in fact, trying to kill large numbers of Americans.
The volume of reporting indicating an Al-Qaeda intention to carry out a serious attack was of such a magnitude that you could not fail to notice it.
And John McLaughlin, Deputy Director of the CIA.
The system was blinking red.
So, and the reason I footnote all this stuff is that by giving you the names as you hear the audio, is the documentary is easily dismissible if you, without the credible sources that are included in it. And so, so that's why you need to hear the names, because they're all credible people that did a lot of work in it. And really the takeaway from it that you're going to hear in a minute is the whole Don Rumsfeld thing. Like, where does this come from? And even then, it's almost eerie in that the echoes of Vietnam in the way we go to war in Iraq, and then the expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan. I mean, I think last night at the end of it, you know, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. And I think that's the tragedy of Iraq and Afghanistan, is that if you talk to smart people, you know, you go in and you do what you're going to do to bin Laden, you put the government of Afghanistan on notice that says, we'll be back. We're going to watch. We'll be back. And if any of this stuff goes on again, but you don't attempt to take over the country, you don't attempt to turn Afghanistan into something that Afghanistan has never been, or else you will be there for a long, long, long time. If you choose that road, you need to prepare your population for the sacrifice and the duration that it's going to take. And if you don't do any of that, then you're a fool. Then you're a fool. So here's a
crescendo of intelligence indicates that an Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. is imminent. Just after July 4th, CIA analysts turn up disturbing new information.
The reporting shows Al-Qaeda operatives moving, leaving their bases, It shows preparation for attacks directed at the United States, either at a facility overseas or somewhere in the homeland.
Again, Deputy Director of the CIA, John McLaughlin. That's the interesting part of this thing, is it's not a bunch of yo-yos.
That was a tipping point in the thinking of our counterterrorism specialists, and they showed up in George Tenet's office. And George, who was a very decisive guy, picked up the phone on his desk that connected...
Tenet's the director of the CIA under Bush.
...did him to the White House and said to Condi Rice, we need to come and see you right now. She cleared her calendar, to her credit, and George and several people jumped in a car and raced down there.
Dick Clark went through the masthead of what the intelligence said. They're expecting 8 attacks to go off. It's going to be, you know, a world-class event. And this is real, and their objective is the destruction of the United States. After this, Condi Rice turned to Dick and said, Dick, do you agree? Dick put his head between his two hands and put his elbows on his knees and shook his head and said, yes. She turned to me and said, Kofor, what do we do?
Kofor's a CIA guy.
This is a very loud voice. This country's got to go on a war footing now. And then I used my fist and slammed the table. And she said, okay.
Now, mind you, this is what Gunnar told me to watch, right? Mind you, this is taking place in July. In July.
Afterwards, we congratulated each other in the sense that we'd finally gotten through to these people.
Our people went away from that meeting with a sense that something would occur as a result of it, something that would be useful in thwarting the attacks. As it turned out, not much really changed as a result of that meeting.
Despite warnings from top CIA and FBI officials, the White House, the President, and the Cabinet do not act. Stephen Hadley is Condoleezza Rice's deputy.
When Kofor Black, who's with the intelligence community, says we ought to be on a war footing, and when intelligence community all the time comes in and says, Mr. President, there's a threat, the question then becomes...
Hadley actually laughs when he says that, right? And he'll talk about what he's implying is a little boy who cries wolf.
Okay, what are you recommending we do about it? That's the question. And I don't think we ever got a real answer for that.
For those sounding the alarm, the sense of threat intensifies. At the CIA Counterterrorism Center, Cynthia Storr and her colleagues frantically sift through clues.
Basically, none of us had a life. By that time, I had come fully into panic mode along with everybody else. Not panic so you can't work, but really, really scared that we weren't going to be able to stop whatever it was. You know, we were trying to get the policymakers to understand that Al-Qaeda was about to up their game.
August 6th, President Bush is on vacation in Crawford, Texas. He's hearing about, episodically, the reporting we have about an attack. And he says, can you bring me up to date on this? Where do we stand on all of this?
We wrote a President's Daily Brief entitled, Bin Laden Determined.
Her name is Barbara Sood. She's a CIA analyst, right? So she's in charge of writing the brief.
To strike in U.S.
Barbara Sood was the principal author.
That President's Daily Brief stressed their intent is definitely to attack. They have the capability. And there's mysterious stuff going on right now, but we don't know what it all means.
It says in one paragraph that Bin Laden probably has an infrastructure of sorts here. It notes that there have been observations of terrorists doing casing and surveillance of federal buildings in New York. So it is a very alarming report.
Everybody was talking about something's going on, trying to figure out how to stop it, trying to figure out how to connect the bits. It was just this feeling that I almost don't even know how to describe it. It's like the sky is going to fall and we can't stop it.
I don't remember a time in a 32-year career when I felt every day like we were dealing with a ticking time bomb scenario. We could not define the method, the timing, but we could feel it coming.
Yeah, so Musselman tells me to watch this. And when you watch this and you hear that kind of information, what do you say? My sense when he told me about it was that, you know, it's some of the things that we experienced. And there is, in one of the things that you get pointed at in this whole thing is the disconnect between the CIA and the FBI. They both live in stovepipe worlds, right? They don't play well with each other. And so, in this case, obviously, it's a historic case of that brings needed changes in our intelligence apparatus and the way it works together. Because what they ultimately have, and I'll play a little clip here, and it's an FBI guy talking. The CIA tracks two guys from Malaysia linked to Al-Qaeda who are actually guys who are going to be part of the muscle that takes over the plane. They meet in Malaysia. The CIA finds out about it. And I'll play the FBI guy here in a second. And the CIA is tracking them. Here you go. All right. And so the CIA doesn't turn. They come to the United States from the meeting in Malaysia where the CIA tracks them. They fly to the United States, to the continental United States. I think they land in L.A. and they go to San Diego. There's supposed to be a handoff there. There's supposed to be an alert to the FBI that these guys are in the United States. Now, God only knows what happens if you yoke them up or begin to surveil them and what they say on their phones, or you physically yoke them up and you find out the different phone numbers and who they're talking to and you start pulling on that string. What do you find? All right, and you'll listen to his frustration about it.
Bangkok. And at some point, they leave Bangkok and come to the United States. They have U.S. visas.
For reasons unknown, the CIA does not place Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi on the terrorist watch list. The two men now settle in San Diego.
A cable came in from the Malaysia station that spoke about the arrival of Khalid Al-Midar.
This is Mark Rossini. He's an FBI special agent working with the CIA, okay? So he's working inside of the CIA operation on this Al-Qaeda thing, right? So he can't just transition information over to the FBI. He's got to go through CIA channels. And this is a guy who he's rip shit about what happened.
And other terrorists into the U.S.
FBI agent Mark Rossini and his colleague Doug Miller are deployed at Alex Station, the CIA's Bin Laden Bureau in Northern Virginia. When they learn that two known Al-Qaeda figures have arrived in the U.S., Miller quickly writes up a cable for his supervisors at FBI headquarters.
In the CIA, everything is electronic. There's no paper, okay? And when you write any cable, you have an electronic cue. The people that you know that it's got to go to this person, that person, that person, for them to sign off on it and check the box. And then eventually it goes out the door, and it goes to who it was directed to, obviously in this case, the FBI. So Doug puts on the list of people to sign off on it. Me, the first. And then it goes to the person after me. And it sits there for about, I think like a day or two. So Doug says, hey, my cable's not moving out of so-and-so's cable queue. Can you find out what's going on? And I go to this person's desk. Hey, Doug's cable, what's going on? You're not sending it. No, we're not going to send it. Well, why not? It's CIA information.
Rossini and Miller have stumbled across an old story in American intelligence, a firewall spanning decades, the refusal to share data between two rival agencies.
The CIA is supposed to stay out of domestic spying, and the FBI is in charge of keeping track of domestic radicals, and there was a long tradition of rivalry between the two agencies. There were not laws that encouraged them to cooperate. The problem was that these terrorism networks were crossing borders, so they were challenging the stovepiped American system. It was difficult for the CIA and the FBI to cooperate fluidly as people they were targeting crossed borders.
In this case, neglecting to share information would go on to become one of the costliest missed signals on the road to 9/11.
After 9/11, what we put together circumstantially was discussed at the meeting in Malaysia was the planning and assignment given to Nawaf Hamzi and Khaleda Mihdhar. Go to the U.S. and await further instruction. You're going to be part of something big.
Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Mihdhar have settled into their lives in San Diego. Now they wait. And in June 2000, members of the Hamburg cell start to arrive.
So, what you have here is the beginning of, and then they document the flight training of the four pilots. They come to the United States, and again, this is the summer of 2000, okay? And so they document the flight training of these guys. And what's awful is, and hold on, this is the FBI guy again. The FBI guy in all of this, this Mark Rossini, he's the most livid out of everybody. He sees in this the arrogance of the CIA and them playing stupid games with American lives and American intelligence that ultimately probably caused the intelligence community the single greatest opportunity to either diminish or thwart the attack on September 11th. And what's curious about this, and what's curious about this whole documentary in general, is the participation of of pretty substantial people in it who are willing to speak frankly. You know, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Shelton, speaking, about Don Rumsfeld's comments, that doesn't happen often. Okay? You don't normally see them participating in documentaries, which, again, makes this interesting. Here's more from the FBI perspective.
In Washington, there's an overwhelming sense an attack is coming. On August 23rd, 2001...
Okay, so now the pilots had come, the security guys were in the country, and then the pilots had shown up. They'd gone through flight training, and in the summer, they're finishing their flight training.
CIA officials send a bulletin to the FBI about two men they've just added to the terrorist watch list.
The FBI in New York is requested to find Khalid al-Mihdhar, Nawaf al-Hazmi. Routine, not with any urgency, find the following guys. This is his name, state of birth, maybe his passport, And their last known destination, in particular of Khalil Amidhar, was the Marriott Hotel in New York. The detail about why they're important and why they're evil is not given. That was too late. They weren't found.
The hijacker.
You could tell Rossini's a little bitter. And he gets even more bitter here. You'll hear the next part where he talks about why this was missed and what the CIA was trying to do. And so I'll let you hear him in his own words. But again, if you're just tuning in, Musselman, this is just a few audio cuts that people have been asking me to do about this program, the Road to 9/11, and the FBI guy, as I've said, he's out of his mind about it still, as he should be. Nobody from the CIA comes on the program to comment about the purpose of it, and you hear people talk about what they thought the CIA's purpose in not telling the FBI that these Al-Qaeda guys were in the country. And even when ultimately they said these guys need to be found, it's a routine request and there's no background given to anybody about it. And so the conduct of the CIA is... All right, hold on. Here they are, in their own words.
Tower number one is on fire. Just a huge explosion. Sorry, little data companies in the area.
I was at the Ronald Reagan building a few blocks from the White House giving a speech.
I was in the nation's capital briefing a group of members of Congress.
Leon Panetta.
About oceans issues.
I was in my office on the 7th floor of CIA headquarters. TV was on all the time.
And as I go into my office...
This is Rossini.
People are watching TV, and woof, second plane hits.
This is not a movie. This is actually happening. And many of our friends, many of our colleagues, many people that we probably know, we're watching them dying.
Then they talk about the aftermath of that day and the anguish that they felt. And you'll hear...
9/11...
Every time I back it up, they play commercials in this thing. So here you go.
It is seen as one of the great intelligence disasters in American history.
Well, it was a failure. It was a collective failure. But the information...
This is Stephen Call, C-O-L-L. He wrote a book called Ghost Wars.
...wasn't missed. It just wasn't acted upon the right way.
The FBI should have been notified...
Here's Rossini again.
If the FBI had known about the guys coming from Malaysia landing in L.A., we would have followed them. And maybe would have arrested them or disrupted them. The 9/11 attack did not have to happen. I can't get it out of my head that it didn't have to happen. This is why I wake up at night. This is why I think about it all the time. My heart is permanently broken.
The CIA's own Inspector General concluded in a 2014 report that at least 50 people knew about the hijackers' arrival and didn't share it. But CIA officials insist that they didn't deliberately withhold anything from the FBI.
Back then,
It's a different time, different priorities, different policy machinery. Across the intelligence community as a whole, there was not the same atmosphere of sharing that developed after 9/11. Were we as good as we could have been? No. Were we as bad as everyone thinks we were? No.
This information should have been released sooner than it was.
This is that Kofor Black, counterintelligence coordinator for the CIA.
People did it as hard and as fast as they could. It's this idea that we were trying to, you know, hide information is nonsense.
Okay, that's the CIA. Now you'll get to hear the FBI.
Unbearable questions still divide the people who were there. Why was that FBI cable initially blocked? And why did it take the CIA agents who knew that Al-Midar and Al-Hazmi were in the U.S. so long to share that information with the FBI?
I believe that what happened was the CIA learned that there were two Al-Qaeda operatives that had flown from Bangkok and were in Los Angeles at the time. I believe they saw that as an opportunity to approach them and see if they could develop them as intelligence sources. Probably violated the rules about what CIA can do. But more importantly, it took an enormous risk if it happened.
Again, this is Richard Clark, the counterterrorism director for the Bush administration and for the Clinton administration.
Because it risked allowing Al-Qaeda operatives to be in the United States.
The CIA declined to comment on Richard Clark's theory. But former FBI agent Mark Rossini shares Clark's suspicions.
Hold on to your hat, sports fan.
A group of people had a delusional f***ing belief that they could recruit somebody in a cell, and they got out of hand. And they kept the FBI purposely out of it because they didn't want the FBI interfering with their little fantasy James Bond operation. That's what happened.
Those bleeps were bleeping out the word fucking. He's pissed. All right? So, according to the FBI, the CIA was trying to turn those guys instead of following them, surveilling them, and maybe what I would say, yoking them up. Yoking them up and, you know, and then extracting whatever information you could extract. And then... So they were the best lead. They were followed. They were known. CIA didn't do what they were supposed to do. FBI, as you can tell, not real happy about it. Now this is the part where I wanted to, one of the parts I wanted to play for you. Here's Hugh Shelton. We'll talk here in a few seconds about how this whole how Iraq shows up in it. And this is the part Mike told me that Mac, when you listen to this, your head's going to explode.
Disasters and warn people about those disasters. But the curse was that she would never be believed.
In the web of warnings, of missed signals, of failures to imagine the unimaginable, there were those who saw glimmers of what was coming. But in the end, they couldn't put all the pieces together in time to prevent 9/11.
The frustrating part of this history is that we wouldn't have had to stop every attack Al-Qaeda attempted. We just had to stop this one. This was an attack of unprecedented scale. This was the one that changed the world.
Everybody asked the question, how the hell could this happen? But having been on the inside, I think in many ways, the responsibility rests on all of us.
That's Leon Panetta.
9/11 transformed the world, a seismic shift that laid the foundations of many of today's conflicts. The first rumblings of that change registered within hours of the attacks.
We started talking about retaliation.
Richard Clark. And there's a picture of Clark, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell.
And Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, said, yeah, well, I suppose we have to bomb Afghanistan, but there aren't enough targets in Afghanistan. We need to blow up a lot of things, so we should bomb Iraq. It seemed mad.
Okay, now, That's Richard Clark talking about Rumsfeld, using the word mad, okay? That's why this is so unique and why the audio is so powerful.
I injected myself into it and said, we have...
Okay, now this is Hugh Shelton, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, okay?
We have no indication that there's an al-Qaeda threat from Iraq. But if we go after them, we probably will create an al-Qaeda threat within Iraq before it's over because we'll be viewed again as the infidels from the West.
The president made his decision. First things first, we needed to do something about al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That was the priority.
Stephen Hadley, Condoleezza Rice's Deputy National Security Advisor.
I'll never forget, a little bit later, Rumsfeld said, I heard what the president said, but I want you to continue to refine those plans for Iraq, and let's keep those alive. Let's don't let them die. Now, we've got to convince the president that we've got to go into Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein.
Donald Rumsfeld declined to comment.
In watching the, I don't know what you say about that, in watching the Vietnam series, the parallels between Vietnam and Iraq are incredible, absolutely incredible. And we didn't learn from history. You had people like Don Rumsfeld that betrayed the nation. And I don't know another better word to use for what he did. And then you had guys like Colin Powell who would not stand up and say, no, we're not doing this. And so we find ourselves with a destabilized Middle East. And today, I'll go through the news headlines here on the early bird, but much of the early bird today centers around centers around the Kurds. And what will become of them? Will they become the latest ally who's thrown in with the United States only to be abandoned by the United States? Will the United States look at Turkey? And will they look at Iraq and say, we won't allow you to hammer them? What does the United States do to then have Iraq turn towards Iran and say, okay, fine. To then have Turkey, turn towards Russia and say, get out of Incirlik. You're no longer, you can't use that base anymore. Your policy is now fundamentally opposed to Turkish national interests. And it's not supposed to be that way, given the fact that you're a NATO member. Or the pathetic part of the last part of the series last night was what happened to the people who had thrown in with us in South Vietnam, the pledges we had made, to include the pledges the week that we left, telling people we weren't leaving, in order to manage leaving. Are the Kurds going to be the latest version of that? It's icky. And I don't doubt that the problems are difficult, but it just seems like we screw it up so much. That it's just absolutely positively brutal to watch it. Here's an email. I hadn't watched the program, although I've heard you and Gunnar talk about it on several occasions. Good God, I just wrote it down on my planner to watch it this weekend. I had no idea that there was that much intelligence. Honestly, it's stunning. Absolutely, positively stunning when you hear, when you hear somebody say the system was blinking red. We knew it was coming. And then again, I get it. You know it's coming, but if you don't have any indication of who's in it, or what they're doing, it's pretty difficult to stop it, okay? But then all of a sudden we get indications that, you know, there's guys that we've identified with Al-Qaeda that are in the United States, and we screw it up as a nation. Chiefly the CIA screws it up. So, yeah, hold on, this email goes on. I did watch the Vietnam thing. Watching last night was pretty gut-wrenching, what we did to the Vietnamese people. How about the video of the dude jumping out of the helicopter as it hovered off one of our ships at sea? How crazy was that? I'll tell you, it was straight up crazy. It's a Huey that's a pilot had flown out there, and then he tilts it to his right, and then he jumps out the left. And you see the helicopter crash into the water, and you see him plunge in the water. Now, the question is, did they get him? Did he survive? You see all the, everybody will remember the boat people, the thousands and thousands of boat people, thousands lost their lives in that. Again, that exodus. So, will the Kurds be the next version of that? How does the United States, quote unquote, manage that? And I would tell you this, to me, you know, I don't know that the United States would allow the Turks to go into Iraq. And I don't know that the Iraqis can beat the Kurds. So the best outcome is that the United States tells Turkey to stay in your own lane, and that the Kurds fight to a standstill the Iraqis. And then, in some kind of peace arrangement, the Kurds are able to carve out their own federal state inside Iraq. Because let me tell you, the significance of the Kurdish land is the oil. Otherwise, you know, if you ask for part of the Western Desert, you know, I'm sure the Shiites would say, take it. We don't care. We don't go out there. It's nothing to us. But the land the Kurds live in, that's oil country. That's revenue. So that's going nowhere. So again, interesting. First of all, thank the Gunner. He's going to join us here in a few minutes. But thank the Gunner. If you haven't seen it, it's The Road to 9/11. I think you can watch it on the History Channel on their website until October 11th, I think. I think it's available there, but it's pretty stunning audio. So I wanted to play that by request. So we're going to take a break. We come back. Mike Musselman will join us as we continue here on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We'll get Ben Connable back on. And that's what I'm most curious to hear from Ben. Like, what happens to the Kurds? You know, in this four-sided event where you have Turkey, the Kurds, Iraq, probably five-sided event, Iran, and the United States, how does it get resolved? All right, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.